let's take a look at this. Yesterday, the end of last week, an impassioned call, at the very least, an impassioned call for the immediate resignation of SIU President Randy Dunn.
Yeah, you know what? I think a lot of attention has been placed on words that the president used in emails. I got to tell you, I'm not as concerned about the words that were used. I'm more concerned about what appears to be some backdoor dealings that went on with Edwardsville legislators and Edwardsville representatives of the university. President Dunn was hired to lead the university system, SIU system. Our competition is not Edwardsville in Carbondale. Our competition is Murray State, SEMO, and U of I. And I think something that's been left out in all of this conversation is if Edwardsville separates from Carbondale, Edwardsville cannot have transferred to it the research designation that is special for our university system. And Carbondale, I don't believe, could stay healthy enough to maintain that designation without Edwardsville. We're all in this together. And the person at the top leading that should demonstrate that and not be doing dirty deals behind the scenes.
All right. So you're still, along with other legislators, I know at least two, I could be wrong, that was my last count, are also joining the call for his immediate resignation.
That's true. Chad Hayes and Representative Finney. There are others in the legislature who have kids who are at SIU Carbondale. I believe they may be close behind and asking for that resignation as well. It's in the court now of the trustees, and I believe that the trustees have information that they still have not released. I think everyone's been trying to be adults in this, but honestly, you cannot have the person at the top working against one-third of the system and then have that person remain at the top. So I hope that the trustees will continue to look at this very closely. I hope that they'll continue to release information that they have. I think it was very unfair to take what they did at their retreat in calling for a real look at how the money should be distributed. That was done in March, and then President Dunn kind of hijacked the whole conversation and immediately began to try to move that money without the study. I've said very clearly, do the study, and if the study indicates that shift needs to be made, I want the health of the system. So I could support that if an independent study is done. But right now, no study has been done. There's a fake 60-40 split conversation going on. There's no evidence that there ever has been that. And I got to tell you, President Dunn was the chancellor for a year and then has been the president when Chancellor Caldwell was there. There was never any call at that point to split the campuses. There was never any call at that point to shift this money. Clearly, there wasn't a 60-40 split at that time. So I think it's a little bit suspect right now when the president has not supported the chancellor and then cuts his legs out from under him at every turn. SIU Carbondale needs to have the time to get itself healthy again, and it will do that through the reorganization that's coming. And I think that we need to be supporting that.
I've tried to put myself in your shoes and try to understand your specific perspective, and it's interesting because whenever I tried to do that, I don't know how successful I am, so I'm going to try that out. This is purely conjecture from me in your shoes. Do you mind if I try that?
No, go ahead.
Taxon Terry Bryant, all right, that label was applied to you. You went to the House floor and you said, I'm a Republican, I'm voting for a tax increase. And the reason why you said I'm voting for this tax increase is because SIU needs it. We've got to keep our school and the economic engine that it is on track. And you put yourself out on a limb within your party, within your voter base, within your district by doing so. And then after you put your effort out, that you see that SIU does not reciprocating, make it also some type of more effective strides towards being effective in administration, more effective with money, and that ultimately this is what you had a goal. You put yourself out there, and then you see that it's not being done on their part, and you feel betrayed.
I do, somewhat, because I believe that Chancellor Montemagno is doing the things that we've asked him to do. He's reorganizing in some ways that are not very popular. However, much of what he's doing has to be done. We know clearly that his reputation has been damaged throughout on agreements that were made. It's becoming more and more evident that it was agreed to that when the chancellor came, that a job would be given to his daughter and son-in-law, and people can argue whether that's appropriate or not, but the fact is the president agreed to that. His moving expenses were agreed to by the president. There's not an argument that was done, except that the president hasn't stepped up to clear that up. So I would say, you know, we're doing the reorganization at Carbondale. You can't then transfer $5.1 million to Edwardsville in the middle of that reorganization with no clear reason why, other than, well, for many years there's been a 60-40 split. First of all, there's no proof that there was ever a 60-40 split. It's never been split 60-40. So that's very disingenuous conversation. I forget about my sticking my neck out. The fact is that SIU is our economic engine in Southern Illinois, and we have to keep the system healthy. You don't keep the system healthy by damaging it in a way that causes it to lose its research designation, because then the only university in the state that has that Carnegie designation is U of I. We are special. University of Illinois and Southern Illinois University are special within this state. Don't do things that will damage that designation. Keep us together as a university system and keep all parts of it healthy. That's what the leader at the top should be doing. And until President Dunn shows that he's doing that, I'm going to continue to call for his resignation.
It's interesting. University of Illinois announced that over the weekend, $263 million in construction projects, 10 projects, $263 million. And let's talk about another million-dollar figure. The state not paying for the health insurance of its teachers for the last 17 months at a cost of $110 million per month. This for teachers and retirees, a total of $170 million that some of these teachers, retirees, are being cut off from having doctor visits, medications, and surgeries. I'm just learning more about this from teachers. I've got a note here that says if they have anything done, they've literally have to pay for themselves if they go to the hospital, whatever they're still doing. Now the employees are still paying the amounts they're supposed to pay. It's the state not paying their obligation regarding health care. And I was wondering, is this true? The state's not paying for the insurance? Are teachers still doing it? And then they're being denied health care assistance.
Well, for many months, all state employees' health insurance was being held up. So the state employees were paying their part. The state was not paying their portion of it. So I will have to look and see why the teachers is not being paid, because I believe at this point, other state employees, Department of Corrections, IDOT, so on, their health insurance premiums have been paid by the state. I need to look and see if it's actually that it's not being paid because maybe the comptroller, she is prioritizing payments. Is it that we did not appropriate the money give her the authorization through appropriations to do it, or is it just that it's part of how she's prioritizing things? But certainly we want that health insurance to be paid. That was my goal, to get all of this backlog of bills paid down. I'm being told that we've paid it down now from $16.5 billion down to roughly $6.5 billion, which kind of changes, on any given day which bills have been paid. But revenue is coming in. Even Leader Durkin made a comment last week that with the new revenue coming in, it's made it easier to negotiate the budget for this year. So I can't imagine why that is not being paid, and I certainly am going to be taking a look at that this week.
All right. New proposition, in particular the one I saw with Andy Menar in the Senate, saying a $40,000 minimum wage for school teachers, and then a Republican chimes says, but what do we do when that also makes another change in how they're paid for the pension? School teachers, $40,000 raise. There's more than one of these pieces of legislation, and one of them is coming to the House?
Yeah, the one that went through the House was for $40,000. The Senate bill that's coming over is a little bit different. I think it's at $32,000 at this point. We'll call it minimum wage, if you will. The minimum hiring amount for a teacher right now is $10,000. I had agreed that possibly we could change that to $20,000. I'm sorry that I couldn't get the sponsors to move off of the amounts that they have. I know that for us in Southern Illinois, we have districts like Elvarado, in Elkville, we have Farrington up in Jefferson County, and we could probably go on and on and on. This would be devastating to those school districts to have such a large increase. And let's don't forget, we just passed the new school funding formula. The school funding formula hasn't even had a chance yet to, we just started doing the distributions. So we need to see first what's going to happen as we start to put money into the classrooms. Certainly we want to take care of the teachers. Certainly we want to make sure that we have good ones, and that we, you know, we have to compete with teachers again from Missouri and Indiana, because they don't have to work as long to get their pensions. So we're losing teachers to other states, and we do have to fix that. But I would like to see us first let this new school funding formula get legs underneath it, and then a jump from $10,000 to $40,000 or $10,000 to $32,000 is unreasonable. So as that bill comes over, I don't know if it'll pass or not. I don't anticipate the governor signing.
All right, so another question that came in, since the subtext here is pensions, and if we increase wages, pensions have to go up. A listener called. I'm kind of curious because I've been bothered by this since I read the article. It was February 2017, Wall Street Journal report that at the current rate, Illinois would be paying 25% of all revenues through 2044 for pensions. I mean, when you talk about the debt and where the money and where our money is going to be going in the future, 25% of all state revenues going to pay pensions through 2044. What is being done to try to head this off at the pass? We've already let it get out of hand. What's in the process to rein these pension liabilities and the damage they're causing back?
Well, let's remember that a part of this is because we had a ramp. So we're going up into the upper part of the ramp now, which means that the payments have to be larger. There is some talk about amateurizing those pension costs. Of course, you know, then comes in the conversation of, are we kicking the can down the road? Well, we got to pay it. First of all, those are promises made to hardworking folks who came into the system knowing that those promises were made. That's number one. Number two, the Supreme Court has ruled now multiple times that those have to be paid. So clearly, we got to take care of it. And to what is being done, you remember that back in, I think it was 2011, we passed a new Tier 2 pension. We're beginning to see the results of that. But in this last budget, we also have Tier 3. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, Tier 3 has not been implemented yet, and that we've passed several cleanup bills to make that better and to move that forward, and it still has not been implemented. So there are some fixes there. There are some things on the table that we can take a look at, but I don't know why things are moving so slowly.
So you're on your way now to a conference?
I'm on my way to a task force meeting. I'm the chairman of the At-Risk Women's Task Force. The purpose of that is to try to reduce the number of women who are incarcerated, reduce the reasons that cause them to become incarcerated, and also to reduce recidivism. We find that a lot of times we have situations where maybe a woman has had a boyfriend that is a drug dealer, and so we know that women don't get as much time generally as men do, so because some of these women are beat down because of domestic violence. They're kind of forced to take on those charges, to plead those out. And so we have a lot of women being charged with crimes that actually their male abusers are guilty of. So we're looking at a lot of things. How can we reduce this issue in societally? So happy to be the chairman of that task force.
You know, it's interesting. This is something I've been watching very closely. And what happened was, I read the book about Rita Nitz, and and now I've never been able to stop really kind of thinking about that book when I look at these numbers of women in going to prison and the crimes they're going to prison for. This was something that was almost solely the male area of expertise, and now that women
come out of that background.
Yes.
I had a very abusive stepfather, and at age 9, my mother shot and killed my stepfather to save my life. So I have very real history in how women can be pushed into situations that where they offend. And I believe that society and our legal system is not serving them well.
Right, and what we're seeing is significantly larger number of women being sentenced to prison now for a variety of charges, including fraud and robbery and homicide and drug dealing. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this grow in the state of Illinois. What I'm trying to say here is the Women's At-Risk Program is a good idea to start looking to see if we can head some of this off at the pass. Before I let you go today, I got two things I want to ask you about. This hearing on the floor today on the death penalty, the amendatory veto the governor spoke of last week. What's the story there today and procedure?
I really am not sure if the speaker is planning to do a full meeting on the House floor, or if it's going to be discussed in committee. I know that it's supposed to come before Jude Krim today, and I sit on that committee. I believe we're going to just be looking at the amendatory veto. In the amendatory veto, the governor extended the 72-hour waiting period for long guns and for guns like ARs. Right now we have it for handguns, but not for long guns. He wants to extend that 72-hour waiting period for all of them. And then, of course, he introduced this new idea of a death penalty for those who kill law enforcement and people, basically, that boils down to mass shootings. So if you've been involved in a mass shooting and we know exactly who those people are, I've been an advocate of the death penalty. I was sitting on the Senate floor as a guest on the day that was debated. For those who were listening, they might remember that Kwame Raoul, in his floor speech, said we didn't need the death penalty anymore because we had Tam's Correctional Center. And then within a matter of weeks, Quinn began the closure of Tam's Correctional Center. So now we don't have the death penalty. We don't have Tam's, and chaos is happening in the Department of Corrections these days, as it is out on the street. So I think we need to be looking at that. The dilemma is going to be a vote for that bill. You can't vote yes for the death penalty and no for the 72-hour waiting period. So, you're going to be voting on both of them at the same time. So I'm concerned about the 72-hour waiting period because it would be harmful, I believe, to the Sparta Shooting Complex and the Grand American. So from an economic standpoint, that's an issue. And remember that none of these mass shootings that we've seen was anyone who had their firearms who were legal owners, and none of them had to do with the 72-hour waiting period. So often we see bills that are generated because someone has an agenda, not because it's for pure public safety. And I think we need to address those issues rather than go after our Second Amendment rights and legal firearms owners.
Yeah, and then you've got, of course, the Nashville Waffle House shooting where the man from Illinois, his guns had been taken away. His father had been given the guns by law enforcement, and his father turns around and gives them back to the son.
Certainly. So, again, illegal. Now, listen, people need to keep an eye on what's going on Tuesday night at the Jackson County Courthouse, because there is an attempt right now to run a resolution that's opposite of what all the other counties in our region have been doing, which is saying they want to protect our Second Amendment rights. There is an attempt right now by the Democrat leadership and Jackson County Board to run a resolution that supports these gun grabs. So keep an eye on it, folks. You should show up Tuesday night at the Jackson County Board meeting.
My understanding, that's just one board member that presented that.
Well, you know what? It was discussed in a committee.
In committee.
It was voted on, and the concept is moving forward. So don't take any chances.
Right. I think there was only one vote no to move it out of the group. I believe two or three members of the board were not there for that committee hearing, and then I think one voted no, and I believe there were three other maybe at the table. They voted to move it on to the larger group. It's 8:43, 17 before the hour. Did I get something wrong, Terry?
Yeah, no. I'm fighting hard at the state level. Folks at home need to make sure that they're fighting hard at the county level.